Margaret Bootland, Reel 2. So now it's Rangoon, which I believe you said you took a steamer to.
Yes, we had a steamer. And
how many of you were there?
Oh.
The army wives and families.
I can't recall now, but there must have been about 20 women and children, men, husbands, party, and there was... we were met at the docks by the army transport, and then we were taken to Mingledon, which was 13 miles from Rangoon. And we were there, the regiment was there to guard the airport. There was the only airport in the south, and the plane that came over the most was the KLM, you know, the Dutch thing. And I had an upstairs quarter, which was very comfy, and someone said to me, "Do you realise they come along and take up and saw over your house, and if they fail to take off properly, they'll plough into your block of dirt." I said, "No, I never thought of that." But we were happy until the Rangoon riots started. And my husband was in charge of the A Company, and he had to grab his things, and they were off. But he says, "Don't worry, you will be well looked after." Well, that night, there'd been all sorts. We couldn't hear anything much. But someone came and they said that you ladies shouldn't worry because there's going to be a patrol going round the barracks all night. And you can go to bed and you'll be fine. Well, I thought if the rioters should overrun the barracks or anything, what have I got to defend myself? The only thing I had was like a riding whip that... Alan had bought me a port side, which I treasured, and I had it on the wall in the bedroom. So I thought, right. So I brought it in into my bedroom, locked the door up, and about 2 in the morning, there was a gun went off, a gunshot. And I sat up in the bed alarmed. I thought, oh dear, have they attacked the barracks? Because there was only a skeleton staff in the barracks. All the troops had been rushed to Rangoon because of the riots. And then after a bit, somebody came running round. "You can relax, ladies. It's one idiot that took his dog on patrol and he got tangled up in the lead. And when he fell, his gun went off." So he says, "Don't worry. There's no bandits around." That was it.
Well, was there much rioting at that time, 38, 39?
It was soon put down. But when we went into shop in Rangoon, which was once a week, a special train put on Friday for the ladies to go shopping, we did have an armed escort. But no problems. But there were some gruesome details. Police said.
Could you not tell us about the gruesome details?
Well, one of our friends, he was a corporal. His parents were in the barracks, the Thomases. He led a patrol, and someone said there's a lot of fighting going on in a... it was an Indian temple. Somebody took his crew in. And when they got there, these people were praying, but they were all headless. They'd been attacked by the Burmans, and because it's the clash of two religions. I don't think it affected the British much. It was just a quarrel between the Indians and the Burmans. And, it was terrible. But eventually it was put down.
Was there any anti-British feeling, though, that you knew of, you know, in your time?
Well, I never came across it myself.
How about your husband? Did he talk about anything?
Not much, not much. But we'd only been in Rangoon, in Mingladon barracks, when the news came through that the whole battalion was going up to Maimeo, and we were going to be relieved by the Gloucesters, the glorious Gloucesters. And in the November, we travelled over, all the families, I should say, travelled up by train. And, oh boy, was it cold up there, because it was a hill station. But it was a lovely place to be, and we liked it very much.
What sort of accommodation were you given there, in Maimeo?
The first one I had, I had two. One large living room with a kitchen at the back, and two bedrooms. And one bedroom had a communicating door with the next quarter, could be opened up for an extra room. And I was lucky because the Bugle Major Thomas and his wife lived next door, and she was a treasure. She really was. She advised me. She'd been out so long. Advised me in lots of ways. And Iris, her daughter, and Johnny, the youngest boy, they used to take Ian to school for me and bring him back again. And we were very, very close and friendly.
Would that have been an army school, Margaret?
Oh, yes. Yes, this is where Mrs. Mansfield comes in.
Who was Mrs. Mansfield?
Mrs. Mansfield and Miss Baker. I mentioned before, didn't I? I think Miss Baker is dead, because she was white-haired then, and that's 55 years ago. But Mrs. Mansfield, she could be alive, but I doubt it. But the thing is, you'd have to trace her through the army schoolmistresses.
Yes, I think the museum could do that. Yeah, but what were they doing there? Yes, but what were going back to your time there? What were Mrs. Mansfield and Miss Baker doing?
They were army schoolmistresses, and Mrs. Mansfield, her husband, was a lieutenant in the intelligence. She hadn't any children, but she was a first-rate teacher. And Miss Baker was too. And she was due for retirement, but the war stopped her going back. And she ought never to be on our trek. It was too much for her.
Yes, you can tell me about that, you know, when we get to the trek, Margaret.
Right?
That's lovely. Because this early part is so interesting as well. I was thinking, you know, although you'd had the time in Gibraltar and India too, this must have been a very big culture shock for you, being somewhere like Burma. I'm wondering how you were impressed, you know, how your lifestyle changed, your food.
Well, it did, because we had a cook and a houseboy, a Marley when you had a garden, and that was a shock. You'd nothing much to do except go and gossip and do things. Real change.
So how did you spend your time then, apart from organising your servants?
Tennis. We played a lot of tennis and went for walks. And I was going to say that when I played tennis, somebody would take Ian with their children for a walk, or vice versa, we'd take theirs when we were walking. But when you got to Maimeo, you always had a company on detachment in Mandalay. And it wasn't long before we were sent down to Mandalay. You gave your quarter and everything up, and moved down there into furnished quarters. And I really like Mandalay. did, although it was a good way from the city. And
what your quarters were?
Yes.
Yes. What were they like? Were you in a sort of compound there?
Well, more or less, yes. It was army quarters and the barracks and things, more or less. But the sergeant major of the company, he had a detached house, and which eventually Alan and I had. And it was at the bottom, at the foot of Pagoda Hill. Well, Pagoda Hill was a huge thing with a temple at the top. And Alan often called me out at night. He said, come and listen to the bells. And we'd go out. Ian would be in bed. And we'd listen to all the temple bells. We couldn't see them, but we could hear them. And but this night, we'd only been in Mandalay a little while, a couple of weeks, when we decided we'd go walking, and these friends of ours, the Woods, Sergeant Wood and his wife, and they had a daughter, Margaret, 9, and we all went walking across the paddy fields and things like that. And then when we came back, Mrs. Wood was almost next door. They came in for a drink quick and handed Margaret over to the ayah. She put her to bed. And Ian was tired out. He'd be 5. He couldn't go to school. It was like a long holiday for him, the 3 months we were on detachment. And because the only school was in the city, and it was a Burmese school, and he couldn't go there because he didn't understand the language, and it would have been a waste of time. So he just played around. But this evening, Margaret had gone to bed. I put Ian to bed. He was bathed every morning, so he was clean enough. Washed his hands and face, cleaned his teeth, put him to bed, and he fell asleep straight away. Well, where the Woods and Alan and I were chatting away, when Ian shouted, Mummy, can I have the potty, please? So I said, yes, and I knew just where that potty was in the bathroom. So I opened it, and with no electricity, it was all oil lamps. And I went into the bathroom and reached for the potty, and it was just the spot where it was in the corner. And then I felt these thumps on my foot. I thought, oh dear. And I yelled for Alan to bring me a light quickly. And he grabbed the oil, because there were 2 or 3 oil lamps, you know, the old fashioned lamps with the paraffin in and the glass dome. And he came in, and it was a big black scorpion. Now, had I been the night before or the night after, I most probably would have had tennis shoes on, and it would have gone straight through the canvas. But because I've got strong, stout leather walking shoes, I just felt the impact. And so Alan came along, and Ernie Wood brought a hockey stick, and between them they killed it. And I often thought of what a narrow shave I had.
What would that have done to you, Margaret, a scorpion sting?
Well, if I'd been fit and well, I probably would have got away with it. But anyone with a weak heart, the poison kills them. And I always think of what a lucky escape I had. I had a near shave another time, when I'd had a bath, and I was in my dressing gown and slippers, and I kicked my slippers off to curl my feet up to read, because I was a great reader. And then I put my feet out on the carpet, and after a bit, Alice says, for God's sake, put your feet up, Bess. And when I looked, there was a scorpion without very near my foot. He did come in through the open door, because it was so hot at night, you couldn't shut the door, really. And, yes, now of squeaks.
Did you keep? Did you have to have a lot of jabs? You know, inoculations when you went abroad then.
It
seems from what you're saying, Margaret, that the army took very good care of you.
Oh, they did. You can't fault them. At least I can't.